This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. A federal appeals court has once more handed Donald Trump a defeat by striking down the second iteration of his so-called travel ban, which critics refer to as a Muslim ban. Trump's initial executive order curtailing the entry of people from seven Muslim-majority nations suffered several legal defeats. In March, he signed a revised version of the ban, hoping it would stand up in the courts. It did not. In a ruling that was more than 200 pages long, federal judges wrote that the second executive order, quote, speaks with vague words of national security, but in context, grips with religious intolerance, animus, and discrimination. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has vowed to appeal the ruling all the way to the Supreme Court. My guest is Corey Brettschneider, professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality, and Trump versus the Constitution. Welcome back to the program, Corey.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So we've talked about this issue before. Are you terribly surprised that the courts struck this down a second time? Trump and his advisors, I assume, tried to rewrite this so that it would stand up to the courts, but it didn't.
Yes, I wouldn't say I'm surprised, but I'm pleasantly relieved to see that what I thought should happen did happen. And I think that Trump's advisors thought that they could play a fast one. They said things to the effect of, don't worry, it's the same policy. Stephen Miller said something like this. It's the same policy. We're just going to fix it up with some legalese. And the problem is that courts see right through that, as this court did, and are not fooled by what the Trump administration must have thought was clever drafting. They knew it was the same policy, basically, and most importantly, that it was based in that same motive of anti-Muslim animus.
As far as you could tell, what was the major difference? I mean, we know that, for example, the indefinite ban on Syrian refugees was removed, but was there a real finessing? Or was, you know, even in the writing of this executive order, was it so similar to the first one so as to not really constitute too much of a difference?
I do think it's basically the same policy, and as I said, it's based in the same animus towards Islam. Going back to the campaign, he was promising a Muslim ban. I think we now can call this a Muslim ban in the sense that it's based in anti-Muslim animus. But they tried to do certain things that were, I would say, a little different or cosmetic. So, for instance, in the first ban, there was a preference expressed to admit Christian over Muslim refugees. And that was an indicator to the courts that there was something going on here that wasn't right from the perspective of the motive. And they took that out in the second ban. They dropped one of the countries, so that's a difference. But in the end, what the courts were saying is, just as that first ban was clearly motivated by an antipathy or prejudice towards Islam, so this one was too. And what's essential, I think, to recognize is that this is an example. It's important legally, but it's also important because it's the entire Fourth Circuit calling out President Trump really for being bigoted in his motivation here. And that's a historic moment. It's the opposite of what happened in the famous case that's cited by the court of Korematsu, where the court upheld Japanese internment as a policy that was constitutional. That was a huge mistake. And here the Fourth Circuit is making it clear they're not going to do that again.
Hmm. Now, it's certainly disappointing to religious extremists within this country and conservatives who see the constitutional protection of religious freedom as applying only to Christians. But the courts applied it, I suppose, as it should be applied, which is that every religious group should have the freedom to practice their religion without being discriminated against, right? Was that the basis of their ruling?
I think that's an excellent way to put it. I think there are people, certainly in the country, who think that this is a Christian republic or that there's some preference that our system has for Christians, but they don't know anything about the Constitution. And this court made it clear that, exactly as you said, under our Establishment Clause, which the court largely relied on, but also I think we could add the Free Exercise Clause, that you can't favor one religion over another. And the fact that it was so transparent in that first policy that Christians were being preferred to Muslims carried through here in the anti-Muslim animus. And the court, exactly as you said, recognized this value that we protect the religious freedom of all, not some, and that this was really an attempt to establish or to denigrate one religion, and in particular Islam.
And it's a great gift to Muslims as they begin the holy month of Ramadan to have this decision come down. What about, and yeah. This was a decision, by the way, majority of the, I believe it was just 10 judges to three.
The three
Republicans were in favor of the ban and 10 against.
There were 10 votes to strike the policy as unconstitutional, and there was agreement that it was the motive, really, that tanked it, and that our Establishment Clause, as you said, protects all religions, not just some. And I think, you know, what you said about Ramadan is especially important, that this was a vindication of the idea of religious freedom in this country by this court. They really are playing the heroes in defending the Constitution against a president who has repeatedly trampled on it, and in its most obvious way in these two iterations of the travel ban. So I want to read this as a message, not just to Donald Trump, which it is, and an expression of his really incompatibility of his motives with the constitutional system, but also a message to all Americans about the meaning of our First Amendment and the idea that all religions really have a place at the table equally in our system.
The other issue that really needs to be raised in this decision around the Muslim ban is that judges were able to account in their decisions for what Trump himself said about this ban before he was even elected to be president. And this was something that came up the first time this ban was struck down, or when the first version of the ban was struck down. And I understand that Trump's lawyers, the White House lawyers, were attempting to have judges not use Trump's words to in their ruling on this, but that failed, right?
Yes, I think that's a very astute analysis. Trump's lawyers argued a number of things. One was that what he said during the campaign was just words, and it was campaign statements, and it shouldn't count against him. And in fact, they argued you should just look at the text of the order, not the motivation, in order to see whether it was a violation of the establishment or free exercise or the Equal Protection Clause. And the judges in a vast vote, 10 judges, as you said, on the Fourth Circuit, just rejected that. I mean, they said we're not foolish, basically. You can't just lie to us about what the motivation is through clever drafting. We can read the evidence of what was said about the intent of the policy, partly during the campaign, but it was important in the oral argument and in the decision that statement about a Muslim ban remained on the White House website until it was taken down, basically, I think, the day of oral argument or around that time. The way the law works is that intent matters in all sorts of areas. It matters in criminal law, for instance, think of the distinction between manslaughter and murder. And it matters here, too, in constitutional law. It's not acceptable for any branch of government, no matter how high the official, including the President of the United States, to make policy based on prejudice. That's, I would say, not just a core, but maybe the core idea of the First Amendment, in particular its religion clauses.
Now, the fact that Trump just unilaterally put this forward and said this was in the interest of national security was also problematic for the judges, because he didn't consult the various agencies that should have been consulted if national security was really the issue. If one does look at, if he did consult these various agencies, I'm assuming like the National Security Agency, that it might have been determined that a Muslim ban wasn't going to do very much, or ban on people coming from Muslim countries wasn't going to do very much about so-called terrorism in the country. So how important was that aspect of it?
Yeah, I mean, they tried to argue. The lawyers had a number of arguments beyond the ones that we were just talking about not looking to intent. One was that it's the real motive here, the dominant motive is security. And the court looked at that rationale, and I think one thing that helped them to say it wasn't the dominant rationale is the evidence that suggested, and trial court judges had brought this up, that this really wasn't going to do a lot to make Americans safe, maybe not anything, and there was very little evidence that the administration seemed to have to suggest that it was going to increase from the former policy of vetting individuals to this total ban, that there was going to be an increase in security. They also tried to argue something, and this is a historic part of this decision, especially if it's affirmed by the Supreme Court. They tried to argue that in matters of immigration, that the president's power is what they called, citing earlier opinions, plenary or absolute. And there was a case called Mandel, which suggested that in the discrimination against a professor who had Marxist beliefs, that he was barred from the country. They've relied on this to suggest that the president really has a lot of authority in determining who gets in and who doesn't. And there had been an earlier case about Chinese exclusion of Chinese immigrants that the court had said allowed for the president to basically make an absolute decision. And the court, I think, thankfully said, you know what, when it comes to even that vast power over matters of immigration, prejudice is not allowable. And the president's power is not absolute in the sense that he can enact a bigoted executive order.
Now, Corey, just before this ruling came down, the Department of Homeland Security released for the first time details and data on which people who come to this country, who travel to the United States with documents legally, with visas, how many of them overstay their visas and which ones overstay their visas. And this is relevant primarily because a lot of the people who were impacted by the Muslim ban were people who were coming here on visas, student visas, et cetera. Who had gotten permission for being refugees. Also, it's relevant because some of the September 11th hijackers had been people who overstayed their visa. And what it found was that about 1% of people who are issued U.S. visas overstay them, the vast majority of them Canadians. And so I'm wondering if any of this... I'm even wondering if the Homeland Security Department in releasing this data might have been attempting to influence the appeals court decision. But as far as I can tell, there was very little, if not, you know, maybe nothing about people from Muslim majority countries overstaying their visas and committing crimes, et cetera. I mean, not to say that it would never happen, and it certainly did happen on September 11th, but to have such a sledgehammer approach to something right. that can actually be... fixed with better intelligence functioning, you know, I suppose that's part of the problem.
Right. I mean, I think that's exactly the way to frame it. I mean, the question for the courts was whether, in thinking about whether there was a dominant security rationale, whether or not there was an improvement in the policy, this kind of sledgehammer approach, as you rightly called it, as opposed to the more subtle and finely grained approach that had been used previously. In vetting individuals. Was there going to be an improvement in security? And there was just, you know, the burden is on them to show that it's at least rational on the government. And I think they failed to meet that. They clearly failed to meet that burden. I should say, too, even if there was a security rationale, I mean, just imagine that there was. If it turns out that the dominant motive was animus, it doesn't matter. The court, I think, is, in its opinion, seemed to suggest that what matters is what the dominant motive is. And you can't cover up an act of prejudice by throwing in, after the fact, some statistics, even if they have some validity about a legitimate interest like security. And so that's why this is such a strong indictment of Trump himself by the court. It's really about his motives and his bigotry and why that's got no place in the American system.
Corey, Jeff Sessions has promised to appeal this all the way to the Supreme Court. Could that happen? And if so, how might that play out, given that conservatives have a majority on the board, on the Supreme Court?
I think it could. The term is running out soon, so it would have to happen fast. Otherwise, it's delayed until the fall. And then there's an issue about mootness, because there was a limit, my understanding is, on the number of days that the executive order was meant to run for. I guess they could renew it, in which case we could see it in the fall. But in terms of the final outcome of the opinion before the Supreme Court, there are, of course, conservatives and liberals on the court. But I don't think that this is an issue that's a liberal or a conservative issue. I think the issue of discrimination against Islam, against by religion, is something that many conservatives and liberals on the court agree is a problem. So in particular, I guess we could characterize him as a moderate. Justice Kennedy developed much of the doctrine that the court relies on in the Fourth Circuit. The idea of the invalidity of any policy based on animus comes from several of his very important rulings, opinions. In particular, an opinion called Lukumi about discrimination against the Santeria religion, and the gay rights decision, Romer, striking down amendment to the Colorado Constitution, really rescinding many rights of gay people. Now, he wrote those decisions, and this Tenth Circuit is relying on him. He's often the swing vote before the court, so I have to believe that he's going to, well, do the right thing legally and constitutionally and vote with a majority that would hold that this Muslim ban is unconstitutional because it's based in animus towards Islam.
Let's talk about the fact that our president does not seem to understand the Constitution and the rights that are ascribed to all Americans and residents, anybody present in the United States, under the Constitution, and that, you know, it really should be the job of the president more than anybody in the nation to understand and respect and uphold the Constitution. That Trump is not doing that, that he has not done that right out of the gate, that he has talked about the Constitution being too cumbersome. How does that, what are the implications of that for this democracy? And, we've heard a lot about the Russia investigation and possible collusion with Russia and lying over problems with Russia or meetings with Russian diplomats as being the basis for impeachment. But shouldn't violating our Constitution be a bigger reason to impeach a president?
Thank you. That's an excellent question, and I think maybe the most important one in our politics right now. The president takes an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. That's the meaning of the presidency, is that he or she is supposed to be a guardian of that that document and the principles that it stands for. And as you say, this is a president who, and this is one example, has shown not just an ignorance of it, of the Constitution, but a disregard of it. And so when it comes to impeachment, I personally think that there is mounting evidence that there could be a very good case that this president has shown such hostility to the Constitution that there might be a good case for impeachment. Now, the investigation that's ongoing about the links with Russia will tell us something. But already, the reaction of the president to that investigation by firing the FBI director, even if he didn't commit a crime, it shows a hostility to the principle of the rule of law at the heart of the Constitution, that the president is not supposed to really interfere with a criminal investigation, not supposed to obstruct justice, and not to serve as a judge in his own case. He's in this instance of firing Comey for looking into affairs that connect to him, really violating a norm of the Constitution. So I think part of the issues will be legal issues that come out of this investigation. But they also, I think, have to be, in thinking about high crimes and misdemeanors, not just narrow legal issues, but that deep issue that you raise, which is whether or not this is somebody who, in the words of the 25th Amendment, can uphold the Constitution, or whether or not he's shown a fundamental hostility to it. This isn't just a legal question. It's a obligation of the Congress to think about that that oath when they make the decision of whether to impeach or not.
Right. I mean, that seems to me to be a much better justification for impeachment than what, sadly, the Democratic Party seems obsessed over. Well, Corey, as always, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'm sure we'll have you back on the program in the future.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest is Corey Brettschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University, the author of When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality, and Trump versus the Constitution. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.